started to work on this episode about Martine Rothblatt, I emailed our interviewer, Mary Jordan, and said, "Mary, I'm feeling a little paralyzed. There's so many facets to this woman's story, I'm not sure where to begin. There's her creation of SiriusXM radio, her development of the first car tracking satellite technology, her move to biotech to save her daughter, who was diagnosed with a terminal disease. Then there's her life as a lawyer, an entrepreneur, and a transgender activist after she transitioned from man to woman at the age of 40. And on top of all of that, she's also a futurist trying to develop radical technologies to clone people's consciousness? What am I supposed to do?" Here's what Mary Jordan wrote me back. Quote, "Martine is actually one of the most interesting people I have ever met. I was struck by how she really has this attitude that she can do anything, that it frees the mind to think differently if we do away with boundaries, including of race and gender." Mary continued, "I often think about how she reads many books at a time because she believes that cross-referencing them, combining them, helps creativity. Martine is wide open," Mary finished, "to people, to ideas, to what the brain can do, to potential." So there you have it, my introduction with Mary's help. Now let's dive in. This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm your host, Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Mary Jordan interviewed Martine Rothblatt at the Academy of Achievement's International Summit in September of 2019. It was held in New York. And Mary, who has a day job as a correspondent for the Washington Post, did the only sensible thing when face-to-face with an interviewee of so many accomplishments. She began at the beginning.
Your father was a dentist.
Yes.
So tell me about growing up.
So it was a good life growing up. And I would say that I really had every advantage. And my parents loved me. They loved each other madly. They were married for like almost 50 years. So it was a great life growing up. But I think it was a great life actually because of things that happened when I was really barely cognizant of what life is all about in my first 10 years. So first, my father was in a horrible car accident. And he was paralyzed as a result of this car accident. Shortly after, he had set up this dental office in a suburb of San Diego. So he had no way to go to the dental office. He was paralyzed on a bed. And he had borrowed all this money to set up the dental office. He had to declare bankruptcy. He had to let go of his employees. And he began studying accounting because he thought that was the only way that he could support his family.
How old were you?
I was 5 years old.
Wow.
So then the next thing that happened was that they found out that there was an experimental procedure, surgery, available at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And he was air ambulanced to Rochester. They fixed his spine, and he came back walking, able to be a dentist again, became a bowler, I mean, you name it. They completely fixed him.
What kind of impact did that have on you?
It had a huge impact because, which I've only really appreciated recently, and I shared this story last month when I opened up at the Mayo Clinic, the world's first lung restoration center, where lungs that are donated after people die but are not useful for transplantation are thrown away, and we take them from the bio waste and restore them to being a perfectly good lung that ends up being transplanted in other people. And so when I cut the ribbon on the center where we do this at the Mayo just a couple weeks ago, I told the story. I said, I want everybody to know I feel especially proud to open up this center at the Mayo Clinic, because I would not be the positive, optimistic person I am if the Mayo Clinic had not really saved my father's life. If I had grown up with a father who was embittered, who felt they studied to be a dentist, and now they were stuck in bed all the time, and he would be embittered, I would have been embittered, I think. I think I would have been a depressed kid, thought of like narrow horizons. Instead, my dad was like, look, I've been cured by technology. Technology is awesome. It's positive. It's given me my life back. And I said, the fact that we have this huge center now at the Mayo Clinic, that's kind of what goes around comes around. You know, you guys saved my father, and I'm here now able to help you save, you know, hundreds of other people who need lung transplants.
Martine Rothblatt says that when she went to the Mayo Clinic to finalize the details of the Lung Restoration Center, a collaboration between Mayo and her company, United Therapeutics, she walked through a reception room that was out of commission with wood paneling from the 1960s.
And it was like, whoa, this is like where I feel my life began.
It began because...
I think it began because that was when my father... that was when, like, in a quantum sense, my life could have gone two directions. It could have gone the life's not fair, and you just have to deal with it, or life is amazing, and you need to celebrate it. That was when, and I saw, like, there was, like, a quantum kind of split there in that hospital reception room at the Mayo, where I had never been in, but I knew for sure my father had been there.
Martine Rothblatt says she ended up taking the happier fork in the road, partly out of luck, but she's careful to point out that her view of luck is a little different. The procedure that saved her father didn't just fall from the skies. Surgeons developed it over years. The Mayo Clinic itself was founded by a pair of brothers who worked tirelessly, with their wives helping behind the scenes. And then, her dad only got referred to Mayo after her parents pushed and pushed their local doctors to find the most cutting-edge treatments. So persistence was a crucial ingredient in their luck. And today, at the company Martine Rothblatt founded, United Therapeutics, one of her mantras is...
Persistence is omnipotence. If you don't give up, you won't fail.
People have called you a perpetual inventor. How old were you when you kind of remember thinking of creating something new that didn't exist before?
I think I must have been in college by that time.
What were you thinking of inventing?
I was thinking of inventing ways to live in space. And thinking of inventing ways to have orbiting space cities that would relieve the overpopulation of the Earth, because the world's population had begun doubling pretty quickly by that time. And I thought that, you know, why are we thinking that there's overpopulation when we're just like on one tiny speck of a planet and there's a vast galaxy of millions, hundreds of millions, actually billions of planets out there? Why can't we build huge colonies that orbit around the Earth, orbit around the Sun, go out and live in space?
Martine Rothblatt says her ideas about that were largely influenced by a Princeton physics professor and writer named Gerard O'Neill, who wrote The High Frontier, Human Colonies in Space. It was the same professor, by the way, who taught Jeff Bezos in the 1980s and inspired him to create Amazon and Blue Origin. Rothblatt joined O'Neill's organization, OASIS, an abbreviation for the Organization for the Advancement of Space, Industrialization, and Settlement. Mary Jordan asked Martine Rothblatt how long she thinks it'll be before people are living in space.
Definitely this century. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I would say 30 years.
And what does it look like?
It looks nice. It does not look like the International Space Station. It looks like what Jerry O'Neill originally wrote about in The High Frontier, and which is a miles-long structure with a blue sky inside it because it's so deep that there's atmosphere. And the people live on the inside cylinder, the inside surface of the cylinder of this structure. The cylinder rotates like this, so there's always artificial Earth gravity on this living surface. So you're walking around, you're not floating around. You have 24-hour sunlight for agricultural areas and normal day and night cycles. It's just like supersizing the biggest malls that we have today.
And would there be an advantage of living up there as opposed to, you know, in Connecticut?
I don't necessarily think so. I think it's different. I couldn't say that one is better than the other. I'm often asked by people, are you going to buy a ticket to go into orbit? And I always say no. I feel I'm on the coolest spaceship of all right now on the Earth. I'm an amateur astronomer. At night, I look at the stars and I treasure the stars. And this is the best spaceship.
Why do you treasure the stars?
They connect me to a larger reality. I always like to transcend the border of my skin. And it's why, to me, love is the most powerful of all forces that, you know, humans ever experience. Because when you love another person, you have transcended your skin. You've bonded with that other person. And there is something in the human spirit that loves to connect.
You also created Sirius XM Satellite Radio.
Yes.
Can you tell us how you came up with that idea?
Yes. So I had previously was responsible for another type of satellite communication system where we would track the locations of vehicles. And that system was actually invented by Dr. O'Neill. And as I got to know him and we shared our vision for building cities in space, settlements in space, he said, Martin, I've come up with this idea for using satellites to locate objects on the Earth. This was before GPS, and I believe that this can help eliminate planes crashing into each other, vehicles getting lost or stolen. It could be more efficient for people. People could find their ways around. Would you be willing to take this idea and get the government to approve it, raise the money for it, and make it happen?
How old were you then?
I was 30. So I said, yes, Dr. O'Neill, I will, because he was my hero, as was Jeff's hero. He's an amazing person. So I did that, and we did launch those satellites and track thousands of vehicles and track planes. Actually, those satellites are still operating today. But as I was doing that, I said, you know, the same signals of sending latitude and longitude could be used for sending music. And it would be a way to connect, to be able to listen to the same channel while you traveled hundreds of miles instead of constantly changing. It would be a way to get the kind of channels that I personally love, which are jazz mostly, be able to get these channels outside of New York or Los Angeles and anywhere in the country.
And did that just come to you one day? You thought, hey, I mean, it's a leap, you know, to move right... and to programming, right?
Well, I'm an amateur musician. You know, I play keyboards and flute, so I'm deeply into music, and I'm running this company that's using satellites to track vehicles, and I had previously been involved in getting the FCC to approve satellites for television broadcasting. So it was kind of logical to say, how can I combine satellites for television broadcasting with satellites to track things moving around? You don't need to watch TV while you're driving, but you do need to listen to music, or now podcasts. And so it was, I think, a natural, logical evolution.
What kind of music do you particularly like to play?
I like to play jazz. I like to play blues. But I also play popular songs. I like to play songs Fly Me to the Moon, you know, just little popular things. I play some classical music. I like to play Chopin Preludes.
So, Martin Rothblatt had a lot of her ducks in a row. Her love of music, her knowledge of the Federal Communications Commission and its regulation of the radio spectrum, and her confidence that there were lots of people like herself who hated to listen to commercials. And what she didn't know, she just figured out in trademark Martine Rothblatt style. It's how she saved her daughter's life, as you'll hear in a couple of minutes, and it's how she launched a new industry, satellite radio.
So I said, how can I go about doing that? There was no more room on the AM and FM radio band, but I knew as a spectrum geek that there was millions of more spectrum than between AM and FM that could be transmitted by satellites, because those frequencies were not used for other things and they passed through the atmosphere. So I studied the physics of it, I designed the satellite communication system, I found the radio frequencies that would pass through the atmosphere and pass through like the leaves and the trees. There's a lot of just devil is in the details issues, like when it rains, leaves absorb more frequencies when they didn't. I pulled all this together. I went to the FCC, which I knew because that was my business, that was my career. I said, I propose we create a satellite digital audio radio system, which is the technical name for Sirius XM.
And they said, oh, sure.
No, they said the first thing they said is it won't work. They said it won't work. That was the very first thing they said. So I built a system. I don't know if you remember, there used to be USA Today was the tallest building across Potomac. So I put a pseudo satellite transmitter on top of that building that had the equivalent power of a satellite in space. And WPFW used to have a station on 8th Street right near Chinatown where it is right now. So I went into their studios.
Not far from the White House. So there was a restriction on height inside Washington, D.C.
That's why I had to go across the river.
Right across the river, you got a big building, and you put this on top.
Yeah, and then I brought the FCC people into my car, and I drove them all around downtown Washington, and I showed them that, no, satellite communications does work. So I said, okay, it works. Secondly, any frequencies that you want are going to have to be taken away from somebody else, because the military uses all these frequencies, television news gathering trucks use these frequencies. All the frequencies are being used by somebody or another, but mostly they're not being used very efficiently. So I then created a grassroots movement of rural organizations. A lot of them were search and rescue type organizations who would benefit from having 24 hours of content being broadcast all the time by satellite, including aircraft in flight. And I had over 300 grassroots organizations, including community groups in places like Oklahoma and Nebraska.
So you were showing the public good.
I proved, because the law says the FCC is supposed to allocate the radio frequencies, quote unquote, in the public interest. So I said the public interest is to have the same diversity of programming in big cities everywhere in the country. Satellites can do it. Then they said, well, it's not legal for one company to control 100 channels across the entire country. In fact, it wasn't even legal for one company to control more than 3 channels in any one city. So I said I had to come up with an entirely new concept for them. I said, well, that's true if it's free, but what if we make people pay for this? And they never thought of that. They said, well, that's something completely different.
And it is subscription-based.
It is subscription-based, and that also gave me the business model that I needed.
Well, what is so unusual here is you're a regulatory expert, you're a lawyer, you're a musician, you're an inventor. The breadth of what you do...
Amateur astronomer.
Yes.
Now I'm stuck being a biotechnologist. I never asked to be one, but that's what I am.
You know, most of us are told, pick one thing and go deep.
You go
deep on many things. And why, when you can do so many things, did you pick that?
So I don't really enjoy being in biology. I think I'm too empathetic a person to be in the life sciences. And in the field I'm in, people are constantly dying. Even our patients are dying. We keep them alive as long as we can, like we have a medicine for neuroblastoma. It saves the lives of half the kids with neuroblastoma. They never get cancer again. They take our medicine for 2 months. 5 years later, they're cured. They still don't have the cancer back. They live a normal life. But the other half of the kids, the medicine doesn't work for. and I meet their parents, and it's some sad stories. We did save our daughter's life. That's beautiful. And she's great. She's in the 30s. She takes our medicine every day. I've met many other people whose the medicine stopped working for them, and eventually they died.
That's how you got into this field, in fact. Is that right?
So yes.
Tell us what happened. Your daughter had a terrible disease.
Yes, pulmonary hypertension.
And what were you doing at the moment?
I was running SiriusXM. It was like, you know, we didn't know what was wrong with our daughter, Genesis. And when a doctor comes in and says he's only seen, you know, less than five patients with this, they all die, they're all kids. All he can recommend us to do is to meet with the transplant coordinator, but not to hold out hope that we're going to find a lung transplant for a person as small as a, you know, 5-6-year-old kid.
And so you said?
I said, let me find anybody who's working on this disease. There were only 20 people in the whole U.S. who were working on it. I did have financial money, resources from taking Sirius public. So I said to them, look, I'll give you grants if you can come up with a medicine for my daughter. They took the grants. They never came up with anything. I contacted all the major pharmaceutical companies. They said, we're not interested in this disease because it only affects 2,000 people. Finally, one doctor said, you know, Martine, I think you're going to, if you want to save Genesis, you're going to have to do it yourself. And I said, myself? I don't know anything about biology. They said, you could figure it out. You've launched these satellites. And that's when the light turned on in my head. And they said, if you don't do this, Genesis is not going to make it.
How old was she?
She was 7 at that time.
Oh, wow.
So then I just, that was a light switch. I said, okay, you know, forget Sirius, forget satellites. My purpose in life is just to save Genesis. So I taught myself biology. I taught myself everything about this just
by reading.
Literally,
you go get the best books, start reading, and start talking to the best biologists?
Literally. That's exactly what I did. Literally. Fortunately, like Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., I know you know where it is, on Michigan Avenue. So my daughter was there week after week after week, and I was there with her, and they had a great library. They had things like, you know, card catalogs and reader's guides that fortunately, us being kids of the 60s, we knew what they were, you know, and so I was able to use those tools, read the books, read the journal articles. I read a journal article, I wouldn't understand it, so I'd go to the dictionary, look up the words I didn't understand, I'd go back to the journal article, I'd find like a high school biology book, then a college anatomy book, and I just kept going back and forth until I could understand what the article
was. How long
were.
Did that take? Months? A year?
It took less than a year. It took less than a year.
So what's your gift there? You can consume and understand knowledge at a rate that most of us can't?
No, I think what I can do is I can pick out the important parts of descriptions of knowledge much more efficiently than most people can. Like if there's a peer-reviewed journal article, most people will try to read the whole article. Okay, that will take a long time. They may fall asleep doing it. They may get a headache from doing it. I can look at this whole article and say, you know, these three paragraphs out of maybe like 100 or 200 paragraphs have the meat of the article. And then I'll look in the references at the back of the article, and I'll go pull every article that article referenced. And I do that until I've reached like a point of diminishing returns where I've digested everything on the field. Then I'll try to write it and talk about it, teach it. They say the way to learn something is to teach it. So I teach it to my daughter, Genesis, in her hospital bed. I taught it to my partner, Bina, you know, back at home.
So for the rest of us mere mortals who want to be more efficient.
Don't worry about the details. It's really as simple as that. Focus on, like, the 30,000-foot view. So the 30,000-foot view that I realized from reading these articles, in the case of my daughter, is that the pulmonary artery, which is the artery that takes blood from the heart to the lungs, is different from every other artery in your body. All the other arteries in your body take blood, which is full of red blood cells that have been freshly oxygenated. So when your heart pumps, all your body gets freshly oxygenated blood, except the pulmonary arteries take blood from your heart, but it takes it to your lungs to get oxygenated. So those arteries are different. They are the only arteries in the body that carry deoxygenated blood. So I said, those arteries must be biochemically different than any other artery. And if I can find a molecule that will speak just to those arteries, I can open up those arteries and leave all the rest of the arteries alone.
And is that the medicine that...
That is the medicine.
And
that's a 30,000-foot view. That's not talking about, like, you know, long names of molecules and stuff like that. That's just, I want a molecule that's going to talk to these arteries that are different.
And basically your company, one of the things they did was make this medicine.
We make this medicine, yeah.
And how old is your daughter now?
She's 32.
Wow.
And she works in our company.
How many other lives do you suppose your company has saved?
Well, we know that we're like over now 50,000 people are living with pulmonary hypertension. And when she was diagnosed, only 2,000 were, because they all died.
How does that feel for you?
I feel, you know, kissed by life. And I think if there's any lesson from my life that can be learned, is that don't think there's anything that you cannot do.
Don't think that there's anything you cannot do. What is something you want to make sure you do before you die?
Create an unlimited supply of transplantable organs. I picked that because I think it picked me. To be frank, one reason I pick it is because I know I can achieve it. I feel it's realistic. I can achieve it. I feel I'm probably the... It sounds arrogant, but I think it's kind of a fact. I think I'm probably the only person in the world that can make that happen a few decades sooner than it would happen otherwise. And it's because I have the resources to do it. I have bit by bit built the teams of scientists who are most competent of doing it. I have the motivation and passion to do it because I am convinced that not only my daughter, but the thousands of people who take our medicines will eventually need a transplant. And
you're talking about lungs, livers?
Lungs, livers, kidneys, and hearts.
Thousands of people will live longer.
Millions.
Millions.
Yep. So right now...
That's a pretty good legacy.
I don't even think about that like that. I mean, to me that's an honor to have that legacy. But for me, it's my purpose in life. I didn't ask to be in the biology field, but life brought me there. So now I'm here. I'm going to be the absolute best biotechnologist I can be. And the particular field that's been set before me is organ transplantation. So I will achieve that before the end of the decade. And I'm equally adamant that I do that in a green fashion, I do that from buildings which have zero carbon footprint and with the organs delivered by helicopters that also have zero carbon footprints.
Oh, yeah. Did I even mention Martine Rothblatt, in addition to being one of the most successful female CEOs in history, also is behind the development of an electric helicopter, which she recently flew for half an hour, a record. When she approached the major helicopter manufacturers with the idea, none would take the job. But Rothblatt, as usual, refused to be deterred. After all, when she achieves her vision of vastly increasing the pool of organs for transplantation, there'll need to be a correspondingly bigger fleet of helicopters to deliver them.
As we sit here, you can see this sparkle that you have and this smile. And you just give off this vibe of being happy.
Thank you.
And do you think your happiness, were you just born with a good disposition, or do you feel like because you've touched so many lives that's kind of where you get that?
I think it goes back to the beginning of our conversation. I think because other individuals helped my parents overcome from car accidents that would have led them to have very depressed lives and would have ended up bringing my sister and I up in a very depressed environment. But because other people before me made the world a better place with science and technology, it allowed me to be brought up in a household of optimism and positivism.
You were talking about grace, an undeserved benefit, as you said. Does everyone have grace?
I believe so. I do believe so.
And why do you single out that word as important? Why is it important?
Because I try to understand in my mind, how is it that out of all the vast stupidity of humanity, we're able to nevertheless move ourselves forward? I think it's this thing called grace, that it starts with a few people wanting to do something to overcome nature, overcome randomness, overcome evilness. And one person does that, they inspire other people. Like now I have 1,000 people in United Therapeutics. If you ask, you know, most anybody in the company, what's our purpose? They say, we are going to create an unlimited supply of transplantable organs. So nobody ever has to die on an organ wait list again. That's grace. That's being courageous in the face of both blind nature, bad luck, and human stupidity.
You have quoted Einstein saying there's two things that are infinite, the universe and human stupidity.
And he wasn't sure about the first. He was certain about the second.
But tell us a little bit more. When you're saying we're stupid, like, give us some examples of things.
Building enough nuclear weapons to kill everybody in the world multiple times over is stupid. Ignoring the absolutely clear evidence that humans are increasing the temperature of the world, the ice caps are melting, and not like turning on a dime to reverse that, but instead in a very realistic, and it's funny how ironic the example is, putting like the pedal to the metal and, you know, and withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accords, you know, spewing more pollution. None of us are angels. We're all sinners. I take trips that I don't need to take. You know, I make more carbon footprint than I need to make. So I'm not saying that I'm any less stupid than everybody else.
But your point is that given all these things that are happening, we still, you stay positive.
Yeah.
And we keep advancing because there's a good energy.
There is a good energy. And I think that that's actually a beautiful synonym for what I mean by grace. And this is, for example, at United Therapeutics, we've built the world's largest zero carbon footprint building. It's in our headquarters in Silver Spring. It has zero carbon footprint. It's a 150,000 square foot, 10-story building full of laboratories. We use the earth as our battery to store all of the heating and cooling.
And have some people come to your place there in Maryland and try to copy that?
I wish more would. It opened up last year. And we put right, I invite you to come and visit it because you live in the D.C. area. We put right on the walls of the building that the purpose of this building is to inspire 1,000 other buildings like this.
Do you sleep?
Oh, yeah. I love sleeping.
Really?
I do.
Come on.
I do love sleeping.
How do you know all these different things if you sleep?
Because I love reading. I am the worst bibliophile in the world. I'm the worst person to go to a museum with because I sit there.
How many books do you read in a week?
Oh, I read at the same time. I mean, my reading habit is I usually read like 10 to 15 books at the same time. So I'll read like a page of this one, a chapter of this one, you know, two chapters of that one, three pages of this one. I really rely on serendipity, like which book I have them open. You know, the ones that are like not the Kindle books, I have them open. And I just, moment to moment, I go by serendipity, which book calls out to me.
And so you could mix a poetry book
with
a biography, with a memoir?
With science, with physics, with astronomy.
Do you think that
helps
you create some of the ideas?
Totally. I will say I am curious about everything. I don't think there's anything that I'm not curious about. Curious about fashion, curious about art, curious about music, curious about architecture. So I'll show you a good example. I was out yesterday for coffee with a friend of mine, Art Kaplan. He's one of them. He probably is the U.S.'s number one bioethicist. And he's at NYU. We're doing, he was important to one thing I wanted to do, which we manufacture these organs. But to manufacture an organ, before you put it in a person, the FDA, of course, wants you to test it in an animal. However, animal is not a person. Their immune system is completely different. And if I manufacture an organ designed to work good in a person, it's not going to work very good in the animal. The animal's immune system will attack it. So I came up with the idea of how about the people who have donated their bodies to science, but we can't use their organs, perhaps because they have an infection or they have cancer, but they've donated their bodies to science. Can we use these bodies that have been donated to science to test our manufactured organs in? So that's like, in a way, it's kind of crazy.
It's crazy that no one thought of it, you mean?
Well, it sounds a little macabre. Anytime you're dealing with dead people, I mean, it's like, this is why I kind of preferred being in satellite communications, because it's cleaner. But nobody thought about it before. I met through, again, serendipity, because I'm curious. I went to the Kennedy Center. There was a concert. I met this guy who is the head of transplant medicine at NYU Medical Center, who he himself had heart failure and needed to have a heart transplant transplanted into him by other members of his own team.
And you went to a concert, and because you met someone, you had a conversation that led you
to testing organs in dead people.
And that is going to save lives.
And that's going to save lives.
Note to self, start going to more concerts. And more importantly, talk to more kinds of people. Because Martine Rothblatt says, diversity is the water of hope.
Now, on a different topic that also speaks to so much about you, what is the biggest misconception about a transgender person?
Well, it's impossible for me to answer that question, because I'm only one transgender person, and every transgender person is different, you know, so I really can't speak for everybody else. I could say for me, it's the conception that I don't want to be one sex and I only want to be the other gender. Okay, so it's the either-or conception. And in fact, I don't really like the boundary of, you know, male or female. I enjoy transcending that boundary. I have male energy, I have female energy. Intellectually, like the tribe that I would claim for myself is the female tribe. I think it's probably more because I'm just in absolute awe, more in awe of women than I am of men. It would be like, you know, picking a sports team that you like better. I mean, the incredible burden that women have. I think women have carried civilization on their backs. And I cannot wrap my head at all around misogyny or racism, these kind of artificial reasons to be against a demographic or a characteristic. It's idiocy to me. I don't understand it, you know. And why somebody else would tell somebody what to do with their own body, I don't get it. So I identify with women, but it doesn't mean that, like, my gender is like just female or just male. My gender is Martine, and I'm very happy just being an individualistic gender. I wrote this book titled The Apartheid of Sex back in the 90s. And while a lot of people now, they don't really know what the word apartheid means, but it meant the artificial division of everybody in South Africa into being either black or white. And you had, like, separate legal rules that went with you if you were black or white. And to me, it's just as artificial to divide all people into saying you're either male or female. If you're male, you've got certain rights. If you got, like, female, you know, you can be paid less and blah, blah, blah. So I don't like artificial borders like that. It runs against my own personal spirit. So to summarize, the biggest misconception about transgender people is that all transgender people want to, like, run away from their old gender and go to a new one. That is true for many people, okay, but it's not true for everybody. And one of the things I'm super, super happy about with the millennial generation is I see so many people coming out as gender non-binary, which is in the apartheid of sex. That's why I called it the apartheid. Is like in that book, I say there really is not just two separate genders. There's a million different genders. And now I've got friends of mine saying, oh, my God, I don't know what to do. My daughter is saying that, like, you know, she doesn't want to be a girl and she doesn't want to be a boy. And she, I said, well, so what? I mean, you know.
What do you tell the parents?
I say, love the person as they are. Love the person as they are. And they usually say things similar to what people said to me being in interracial marriage. They say, oh, well, like, they're going to have a tough time in society. And, you know, your kids are going to be, like, not black or not white. And it's like our spirit is stronger than other people's oppression. Our spirit is stronger than other people's prejudice. The people would rather face social difficulties and overcome them than live their entire life in a mental prison.
In so many ways, you're cross-disciplinary, right? And do you think your own sexuality has somehow helped you think differently than other people?
Probably. If you ask me, like, what's my favorite word? I mean, nobody ever asked me this. I'm just asking myself it right now. I would probably say transcendental. I just love transcending things. In fact, on Twitter, when I describe myself, I say I'm a transcender, not transgender.
Talk about that. What do you mean? You're transcending what?
I'm transcending the border of my body to connect with a greater collectivity. I'm transcending white or black to just be a person. I'm transcending flesh to be a consciousness. I'm transcending earth to be part of our galaxy. I'm transcending limitations to be unlimited.
Hold on to your horses now, because we're heading into Martine Rothblatt's vision of the future, a future where we humans will have virtual replicas of ourselves, cyber-conscious twins.
Basically, a cyber-conscious twin of yourself is essentially like what it says. You're going to have like two minds to manage, and a lot of us can like barely manage our one mind.
I don't quite get that. How am I going to have another mind?
So by uploading your personality, recollections, feelings, mannerisms, beliefs, attitudes, and values digitally, and coupling that with software that can figure out the way you respond to the world, but do that all digitally, there will be a second one of you that is operating outside of your flesh body.
If you're thinking this sounds entirely sci-fi, Martine Rothblatt says, think again. It is coming. And soon. She wrote a book about it several years ago called Virtually Human, The Promise and the Peril of Digital Immortality. The book describes the nascent versions of this cyber-conscious technology already in existence. In fact, Rothblatt's spouse, Bina, has been creating what they call a mind file for several years, and Bina's mind file is housed in a robotic look-alike called Bina 48. Bina 48 has been interviewed by the New York Times and has made appearances with a human caretaker at TED Talks and at tech events, including an MIT Emerging Technology Conference in 2016. Bina 48 even rang the opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange last year. Martine Rothblatt says that, of course, there will be major risks in having your consciousness digitized, but then again, every technological advancement has come with downsides.
People always were willing to accept the problems that went along with the benefits. We like cars, but we have like tens of thousands of people that die every year in car accidents. We accept that because we like cars. We're going to have a lot of emotional pain by having a digital twin, but we'll accept that for the benefits of being able to process twice as much reality as we can do when we're just one mind doing it.
And basically, what we're going to be able to do is take our mind, but basically put it in a computer so that it's artificial intelligence.
Yes.
But it thinks like me.
Yes.
A clone of each.
You will
person.
Be able to, give you an example, you'll be able to do, say, three interviews at the same time of different people. It'll be great content from all three of the interviews. Each of the, say, two digital twins of yourself we'll brief you, we'll give you the Cliff Note version, we'll brief all three of you the Cliff Note version of how the interview went. You can stream it, you can watch it. You may be a little bit slower, your digital twin's a little bit faster. So your mind will literally expand.
And just how soon does Martine Rothblatt think this is all coming?
This century, things are moving very fast, as Ray Kurzweil says, because of the exponential growth in information technology. This century will be equivalent in linear time to 1,000 years. So if I was to say something would take 300 years to happen, it's going to happen in 30 real years.
You think so big. You know, for those listening who want to also do big things,
I would say don't focus on my big thinking. Focus on my practical doing. 1990, I said that I would launch a satellite radio system that would provide 100 channels of non-commercial programming throughout all of North America, and it was launched in 2000. By 2000, I said it was the last thing I did in my life. I would develop a medicine to save Genesis. Okay, develop that medicine. Actually, had three of them approved by 2010. In 2010, I said before the end of the teens, before the end of the 20-teens, we would manufacture an organ and bring an end-stage lung disease patient back to life. It's now 2019, and we've brought hundreds of end-stage lung disease patients back to life with manufactured organs. And now in the 2020s, before the end of this decade, I said I would like develop an unlimited supply of manufactured organs, and that is the purpose of my life during the 2020s, other than just reading, playing music, looking at stars, and hanging out with Bina.
And when people call you an inventor, a visionary, a mom, one of the greatest business minds in the United States, what do you call yourself?
Martine.
With a smile.
The transcendent Martine Rothblatt. She spoke to Mary Jordan at the 2019 Academy of Achievement International Summit in New York City. After your mind has had a chance to stop reeling, please take a moment to post your feedback on Apple Podcasts or wherever you go to fulfill your podcast desires. And one last little detail I can't resist mentioning. Martine told Mary she's been busy rehearsing her flute for the holiday party at United Therapeutics because she'll be joining the band on stage there for one song, Color My World by Chicago. We have to go out on that. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. Our show is generously funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening. Thank you.